1909, Metropolitan Life Insurance Company became the first of several firms to create a company welfare department, a corporate division that set about to improve the well-being of policyholders through health-related projects. MetLife's welfare department established a visiting nurse service, children's programs, baby weeks, swap the fly campaigns, paper drinking cup distribution, and numerous other endeavors. In so doing, they created significant points of contact between the industry and public health personnel, connections that served as transmission points for important concepts of statistical risk, health, and determinations of human longevity. The legacy of those forces remain embedded in the methods carried forward to the present day, and also, I may add, embedded in MetLife's image itself, which is familiar. MetLife does not carry health insurance, and in fact didn't at the point of this study either, but they have continued since the period of busy nurses to identify them as themselves as related directly with provision of health care. This study endeavors to develop a deeper understanding of the emergence of contemporary public health methods by examining the origins of these practices. Few historians have explored the impact of the life insurance industry on the development of public health, and none at all has investigated the motives that might have shaped the industry's actions. In particular, I'd like to address the question, why did Metropolitan Life and its competitors take up public health work at all? The activities of the welfare department grew more expensive by the year. By 1917, the price tag exceeded $176,000, and it continued to grow. One might assume that the advertising and goodwill that the program brought to the company would have more than justified the cost, but independent analysis of MetLife's investment in health and welfare programs has never demonstrated its profitability. In his private correspondence, the director of the department freely admitted that he had no real sense of the welfare service's financial returns. Critics of the program noted that it even reduced the company's financial efficiency, reflecting poorly on the entire industry. It was also impossible to prove that the efforts of the company had any real effect on the morbidity and mortality rate of its clientele. Anecdotal evidence about the good accomplished by visiting nurses abounded, but in truth, their success was part of a much larger trend of declining mortality, whose causes are hotly debated even to the present day. You may notice in this slide, the welfare department starts around 1909, and the decline in mortality has actually begun well before then. And probably would have continued in respect. Certainly, the company's involvement in public health allowed MetLife to place a powerfully marketable spin on risk. Emphasis on protection from hardship from disease and disease served to highlight the presence of these features, a cleverly rendered dual reminder that both frightened the public and offered reassurance that a trustworthy protector stood ready to help. One of the most prominent theories that American historians have used to explain corporate philanthropy is corporate liberalism. Corporate liberalism is the point of view that accepts the organization of the economy into large, privately held corporations and seeks to make those corporations responsible enough toward the larger society and their workers so that fundamental control over politics, finance, and foreign policy is untouched. The theory leaves room for interpretations of corporate behavior that can be at the same time idealistic, practical, and cynical, a mixture that provides some confusing results. So I just want to go through the three main sort of aspects of this theory. First would be idealistic, to help create and maintain a responsible social order. The premise of this is that the well-being of a company is tied directly to the well-being of its customers and workers. So it also has a practical point. The second and more directly practical point would be to gain and retain popular support for their entrepreneurial activity. And the third and more cynical outlook would be that securing the existing social order and political economy by adapting the ideals of middle-class social reformers, social workers, and socialists will help secure the role of the corporation in society. In this presentation, I will examine the goodness of fit of the theory of corporate liberalism to the activities of the Metropolitan Life Welfare Bureau in the early 20th century. Did the life insurance industry engage in public health work out of a commitment to philanthropy, because it made good business sense, or because it provided a new means of control? Or was it a mix of all three? And if so, then what conclusions can be drawn or lessons learned? I believe that an understanding understanding of the motives of the industry is crucial to an understanding of the public health methods of development. At first blush, it would seem that the most idealistic aspects of corporate liberalism were simply inherent in the life insurance industry, whose stated aim was the protection of beneficiaries against financial calamity in the event of a breadwinner's death. Insurance companies were special among American businesses in that they possessed public charters, which identified them as semi-public institutions functioning to a common goal. Charters are also granted to accomplish such tasks as building roads, constructing canals, or conducting banking. They were considered good companies. The oldest American firms in the early 1800s were not shy in advertising their qualities as moral guardians of the people, and based much of their sales appeal on this characteristic. Early insurers also possessed a second and less advertised aim, however, and that was the aggregation of capital. The large reserves of ready cash implicit in their business model allowed insurers to act as valuable institutions of credit for investors in the wider market, a function that was in no way incidental to their existence. Numerous early 19th century insurance companies partnered with banks to raise and apply capital needed for the developing American economy. Now, these two aims are not necessarily in opposition. A well-run insurance company could easily invest its surplus cash and still have enough on hand to make payments on policies. In the early 19th century, sound investments increased the welfare of both the company and the policyholders, another premise of corporate liberalism. To this end, the involvement of the insurance industry in public health work is neither suspicious nor surprising. Many Americans implicitly assumed that the pursuit of business involved a positive social value. Since the beginnings of the 19th century, businesses have served as natural sources for community assistance. Employers often contributed to local charities and advertised on the programs and publications of charitable organizations. Metropolitan life provided nursing care only to its poorest policyholders. When Metropolitan Life launched its welfare program in 1909, 90% of the industrial poor passed serious illnesses at home. Most possessed what was known as fraternal insurance, membership in a brotherly aid society, for which, at the price of about 10 cents a week, a doctor paid by the society might visit them in times of illness. The state of medicine, however, at the time was pretty bleak. This photo was taken in New York City. The infant mortality rate around this period was 1 in 5. So 1 in 5 infants didn't see their first birthday, and approximately 2 in 5 didn't see their 5th birthday. While only a few brotherly aid societies provided health care, all provided burial insurance, a plot, a coffin, a funeral service, and help with the religious rituals surrounding death, such as holding a wake or sitting shiva. In the late 19th century, the life insurance industry innovated on fraternal aid associations by developing insurance policies for the industrial poor. Essentially a commercialization of fraternal insurance, industrial insurance enabled members of the working class to buy policies from companies that were larger and more reliable than brotherly aid societies. Companies referred to these new industrial policies as mass insurance to distinguish them from the more expensive class insurance available to the wealthy. This is a Metropolitan Life Insurance policy, it's an example. Life insurance agents went door to door collecting premiums that ranged from between 3 to 15 cents per week. The benefits purchased began at $70, which is usually just enough to pay the cost of a humble funeral. The visits created an enduring point of contact between big business and the urban poor. Unlike the caricatures of heartless robber barons, numerous businessmen were deeply troubled by the conditions they saw in the rapidly industrializing American cities, and many contributed both their ideas and their resources to help redress social imbalances. Haley Fisk, the vice president of Metropolitan Life, was said to have been one such conscientious individual. In 1909, he hired Lee Frankel to found the company's new welfare department, and Lee Frankel in later years becomes extremely involved in the APHA. Frankel knew much about the struggles of the people who relied on industrial insurance. Prior to his work with Metropolitan Life, Frankel served as a chief officer for the United Hebrew Charities, where one of his roles included making cash disbursements to the deserving poor, mostly women and children who lined up at the foundation's building once a month to receive badly needed alms. Through his work at the charity, Frankel was on friendly terms with most of the city's most prominent social workers and had a warm friendship with Lillian Wall, founder of the Henry Street Settlement on the Lower East Side and New York's visiting nursing service. The MetLife Nursing Service was in fact a brainchild of Wall's, and its core employees were the Henry Street nurses themselves. The services of the visiting nurses were badly needed, and the program grew at an astonishing rate. By 1913, the nurses were administering to over 175,000 patients per year, and in 1917, that figure had jumped to over 242,000, an increase of 38%. MetLife quickly came to augment its nursing service with other features. The Wisdom of Professor Happy is one of several publications targeted toward children involved in the company's Health and Happiness League, which was a nationwide club designed to promote better living and public health. The majority of the company's publications provided instruction on hygiene and disease prevention. They were notable enough that they were soon copied or used directly by state boards of health. And you might notice that some of them also involve first aid. Somewhere on this list there are a couple of first aid. While the effectiveness of the nursing and welfare programs was never conclusively demonstrated, the provision of visiting nurses did help to sell policies. The welfare department helped to boost the sales of industrial insurance that were already soaring. The welfare department starts in 1909, so we know that industrial insurance, which is here, is already very much on the rise, and it keeps on rising. Industrial insurance is becoming enormously popular. It contributed vastly to the expansion of life insurance after the Civil War. The change in scale of the life insurance industry, from a series of small companies to an industry of enormous and lucrative corporations, coincided with the change in its economic aims as well. As aggregators of capital, life insurance companies came to surpass almost every other American industry in the late 19th century. In the four decades from 1865 to 1905, the total annual income of reporting insurance companies grew from $14 million to $230 million, outpacing even the railroads. Jointly, by 1905, the companies had in force approximately $14 billion of insurance, a sum equal to 12% of the total national wealth and exceeding the total value of all manufactured products as well as the value of the railroads. At that time, one half of all American savings were tied up in the life insurance industry, which had become the most important backer of the nation's corporations. Insurers became the great sources of finance necessary to business expansion in the late 19th century. But this was a spirit that contrasted sharply with the stated values of the life insurance industry, for conservative trusteeship. The president of the Mutual Life recognized this delicate balance of corporate objectives when he declared that in the future, the struggle will be between conservatism and audacity. Not surprisingly, audacity took the lead. In this context, the companies involved a third, even more important aim, which was growth. To become the biggest player in the Gilded Age financial system suggested the possibility of controlling the system itself, a prospect that made financial supremacy, not consumer trust, the plumb for which executives strained. The principal goal of most companies was more growth than profit, because these companies served in part as financing vehicles for industrial corporations controlled by the insurance company's directors. The extent of interlocking directorships was substantial and carried important ramifications for the business strategies of insurance companies. Now, this is actually very much the tip of the iceberg, because it doesn't include any relationships between any of the individuals on the, let's see, my left, your on the left, or any of the corporations on the right, and they were all heavily interacting. Oops. So here the tensions and ideals of corporate liberalism begin to mount. While the original aims of the industry was to protect policyholders and aggregate capital had harmonized sufficiently well, the impetus toward growth in the late 19th century was at odds with the role of life insurance as a quasi-public institution. The reality of the industry was one in which its moral identity was strongly outmatched by the exigencies of the business world. Whether or not life insurance executives truly meant their promises of virtue and business integrity, such notions had little place in an economic arena dominated by a race for expansion. The race itself created abuses that tarred the industry's reputation, but, interestingly, not its financial success. In order to express the position of solvency and importance, presidents of the main life insurance companies engaged in a profusion of construction, which you could call an edifice complex. They vied for each other to create the most imposing and impressive corporate headquarters. Their buildings were their billboards, and they spared no expense. Over 35 years, the Big Three, which were the Equitable, Mutual, and New York Life, spent more than $100 million on grandiose office buildings, and they were scarcely alone. This is the interior of the Equitable building, which in 1887 cost $18 million. This is the interior of the Metropolitan Life Insurance building, and it's noteworthy to think about the fact that MetLife was an industrial insurer. So this was built essentially from the 5 and 10 cents contributions of the policyholders. The staircase inside was inspired by the Paris Opera. The president's office was furnished for $90,000. In 1909, MetLife added a tower to their facility that was the tallest on Earth. It's still standing. Naturally, these tactics were enormously expensive, and they undermined the industry's image of responsible frugality. Specialist says this is where the agents are collecting their dimes and nickels. Americans freely denounced the firm's high premiums, low death benefits, and callous disregard for policyholders. One politician declared that the insurance companies were the highway robbers of the 19th century. Theodore Roosevelt included the insurance executives among his malefactors of great wealth. These are some newspaper headlines taken from Chicago Dispatch between 1894 and 1895. They were fairly regular, and these kinds of headlines appeared across the country for at least a decade. The social workers were among the industry's chief detractors, which is a particularly bad set of detractors if you're going to envision yourselves as a social service organization. They asserted that industrial insurers cruelly overcharged the poor. For every dollar of industrial insurance, policyholders typically received only 45 cents of protection, while wealthier families purchasing ordinary policies received twice that. Moreover, while industrial premiums were small, the benefits were also small, and the tight economy of a working class household could scarcely justify the expenditure. For those living close to the margins, payment of the weekly premium could mean doing without meals, coal, medicine, omissions that social workers believed constituted not thrift, but privation. One life insurance agent in New Jersey said, "I have some families that I collect from who would go without food, fire, or fire rather than neglect paying their weekly insurance dues. No, sir, you may write it down for a fact that the large industrial insurance companies exist and gather their huge assets from the money paid in by the poorest of the poor people." Public mistrust was mounting toward the acquisition of private profits through the provision of public good and reflected condemnation of corporate inefficiencies and greed at the expense of the working class. The passage of social insurance bills in Germany in 1884 had already provided a distressing model, which American industrial insurers were anxious to invalidate. Yet rumblings of approval for state insurance reverberated among American social reformers during the 1890s. A government-controlled system would lower administrative costs, it would lower premiums for similar or improved benefits, and it would remove the discomforting arrangement of public work for private gain. Alone among reform propositions, social insurance had the power to threaten the financial supremacy of the business. The Armstrong Committee hearings in 1905 followed this sort of extra wave of antagonism against the insurance industry. And it's in 1909, not too accidentally, that the Welfare Department is created. This widely publicized investigation was in New York State, and the investigation exposed shape-shifting investments, self-dealing, insider training, accounting malpractice, price-fixing, and corporate funding of private pleasures, to name a few. But in short, it was almost every conceivable misuse of corporate power. Many investigations had preceded the Armstrong hearings, and several would follow it, but what set the 1905 proceedings apart from all the others was the work of its talented chief investigator, Charles Evans Hughes. He was said to have an index card mind and scarcely ever left a witness off the hook. The New York Times marveled at his effectiveness. If a witness evades him, he is willing to go around the irresponsive answer with infinite patience and elicit a whole body of collateral facts. Political cartoon from the era. Naturally, the insurance executives were not fond of Hughes. They called him the Grand Inquisitor, and they gave him plenty of evasion to deal with. Now, among the absconders, the reasons for people disappearing was that they were indisposed, on vacation, or missing. And this included several of the most prominent life insurance presidents and vice presidents, and essentially all of the lobbyists for the industry. The Independent chronicled on December 7th, 1905, that indisposition on the part of the insurance officials seems to be rapidly approaching the epidemic stage. Among the findings of the Armstrong Committee, if we went through them in any kind of depth, we really would be here for about 4 months. But among the worst of them, the ones that really powerfully hit the American public, were the salaries of the life insurance executives. Richard McCurdy up there, that's Mutual Life, and his son Robert McCurdy, together the two of them made more than the governors of all the states in the country. John Hegeman, here he's the president of Metropolitan Life, making quite a bit more than the president of the United States. And down here we have the Lilly College professor, at about $1,200. And here we have the next of the worst findings. The political contributions on the part of the companies were really pretty astounding. Hughes managed to uncover what was thought to be just a tiny fraction of them, and you can see that they're pretty interesting. In particular, these contributions to lobbyist Alexander Fields. Fields was running what was called the House of Mirth, which was a mansion in Albany. It was said to be a sumptuous retreat, lavish, boisterous, and conducive to good legislation. The public reaction to this was very, very strong. The New York Evening Post said that a more flagrant betrayal of trust could not well be imagined. Essentially, the American public cried out that these people were not petty thieves, but amazing thieves. And a couple of the more salient comments that came out of the press at this period: this sort of thing must be stopped, or Republican government cannot be maintained. This was a sentiment that was welling up among a lot of Americans in response to these political contributions, which were some of the biggest and the earliest to be exposed. Governor Folk of Missouri said the time may come when the state will insure her own citizens at a far less cost and with far more safety to those who need that protection. This, it seems, to have been the biggest of the reasons for the MetLife visiting nurse program and programs like it. Basically, an attempt to show that the private sector was capable of doing, and doing very well, what the public sector could also do. So just a quick review, these are the tenets of corporate liberalism. We have the idealist tenet, okay, help create and maintain a responsible social order. So in this sense, the efforts of MetLife are extremely useful and conducive to social order. They do gain and retain popular support for the activity of the company, and that policies continue to be bought. But they also land fairly heavily on the cynical properties. They did pretty much succeed in securing the social order, and that this was one of the first periods when there's a press for social insurance,